Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Wisconsin has incredible opportunities for outdoor recreation all year round. Hunting, fishing, and other outdoor activities have for so many years been thought of as male-dominated pastimes, but there's so much research now that shows men aren't the only ones interested in enjoying the great outdoors. In Wisconsin, there are a number of efforts underway to make participation in outdoor activities truly all-inclusive. I'm Shereen Seward. Today on Route 51, we welcome two guests who are both spearheading efforts to diversify participation in outdoor activities. Peggy Farrell is the director of Becoming an Outdoors Woman. This is a program designed to give women opportunities to experience outdoor activities. And we also welcome Marty Moses, the state coordinator for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Peggy and Marty, welcome to Route 51 on this snowy, snowy day.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. We'd like to hear from our listeners as well. Our number is 800-780-9742. If you've got questions for our guests, feel free to call 800-780-9742. So today, we're going to talk a lot about breaking barriers. And Peggy, as the director of Wisconsin's Becoming an Outdoors Woman program, you've been at this for a long time, yes?
Yeah, almost 25 years now.
Well, what is the program all about, really?
Well, the goal of the program is to, as you said, break down barriers to participation for women in outdoor activities, especially those that have been traditionally dominated by men, like hunting and fishing, but also to create educational opportunities for them to learn how to do just about anything in the outdoors, so that including camping, kayaking, nature photography, just observing wildlife. We offer classes like yoga and meditation in the outdoors, so it runs the gamut of all outdoor activities.
Sure. So it's not just hunting and it's not just fishing. There's a lot of different things involved, yes?
Yes.
Okay. And Marty, you work with both Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Explain what these groups do.
Sure. So Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, we're a national conservation organization, and by and large, we are very proud to promote our tagline, which is the Habitat Organization. So for the most part, we are working with landowners to manage wildlife habitat for the sake of conservation, everything from pheasants and quail, other wildlife pollinator species, across the board. And then we also have a lot of education and outreach programs, and then we're also advocating for programs and policies for the sake of conservation of our habitat and wildlife. So that's, you know, the nutshell of our mission across the nation. Here in Wisconsin, for the past 2 years, I've become a partner with the DNR and Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever to promote hunting and fishing recruitment events that we are particularly targeting adult sectors to come and join us. All the publics out there that maybe didn't have the opportunity as a youth to get experience and have an opportunity to go out in the field and try their hand at shooting a shotgun or holding a fishing rod. We're out there trying to provide as many opportunities as we can to do that.
Great. It sounds like the two of you have very different organizations, but some common goals in what you do. Peggy, I've got to tell you, I took a look at all of the upcoming workshops that you've got for Wisconsin's Becoming an Outdoors Woman, and it goes well beyond the hunting and fishing that I would have expected. And I grew up in a family where we didn't hunt, we didn't fish, I wasn't exposed to those things. Is that the kind of woman that is coming to your events?
We actually see a really broad range of interests and backgrounds, but primarily, yes, people who didn't have the opportunity to learn those things growing up as a child. Oftentimes, they get that interest as an adult, but then they don't know where to go. So that's why along with the things that Marty's organization and some other conservation groups are doing, we're also trying to create as many opportunities as possible. So our programs are primarily tailored toward women. We've done a lot of research on how women like to learn, how that's different from the way children like to learn, or how men like to learn. And so we're very focused on creating a safe, non-competitive, all-inclusive kind of learning atmosphere for women. Having said that, though, we're a equal opportunity program, and we have from time to time had men also participate. As Marty was saying, an adult who didn't grow up in a family that did those activities, and they want a safe and non-competitive place to learn.
I like that idea of that safe feeling, that non-competitiveness. I remember the first time I got into a kayak, I was really intimidated by that. And now it's one of my favorite things to do. I think there might be a tendency for some women especially to think they're not strong enough or not experienced enough. I mean, what do you say to people who think that?
Well, we will do everything that we can to get anybody and everybody, regardless of age or physical fitness or physical ability, whatever, to do whatever it is that they set out to want to learn. And sometimes that includes overcoming fears. We've had people who have had a fear of water who said, you know, I signed up to do this because I want to learn how to get over that fear. How can you help me? And so by a lot of one-on-one instruction and hands-on learning, we can take people from the, ooh, I'm not sure if I want to do this, to the, woo-hoo, I just did that stage.
Sure.
So, it's really empowering. It's super rewarding program to be involved with, both for the instructors and the people who participate.
Sure. I was reading some statistics, a new survey by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that says only about 5% of Americans 16 years and older are hunting these days. That's half of what it was 50 years ago. I would imagine that if these kinds of trends continue, that could have some a pretty significant impact on the sport and on conservation. Marty, maybe you can speak to the relationship between hunting and fishing and conservation.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Shereen. That's one of the biggest reasons that I got real involved in this sort of activity work, actually. So my background is a wildlife biologist. My education and all my prior work-related activities have been related to field biology and oftentimes focused on non-game or non-hunted species. So I've always had a strong sense of the science behind our conservation. That being said, I also didn't become a hunter until I was about 28 years old, or 32, actually.
Really?
I'm 40 now, so I came into it as an adult as well, and never had the opportunity to get trained up in the kind of mentored situations that we have. I was calling friends that I knew, but came to it late, mostly because I started to really understand and realize the importance of how fishing and angling plays a big role in conservation. I'd heard it academically, but was starting to see it pan out in reality and wanted to be a part of the solution. I also wanted to put some free-range organic protein into my freezer for a growing family that I had at the time. Still have. We're growing well. But the way that hunting and fishing plays a role in conservation is probably one of the best stories never told or seldom told in the United States. So every time anyone purchases a firearm and ammunition to use that, whether they're going to sporting clays or a trap range, or they're going to just do target practice, or they're going into the field to hunt, the purchase of all that equipment has an embedded excise tax that we don't necessarily see. It's put on the manufacturers, and it's part of the grand total cost. And that was established back in the early 30s. Some forward-thinking conservation legislators at the time, along the lines of Aldo Leopold's, some of his game management theories and land ethic conservation ideals were coming out. And Hugh Hammond Bennett from the Soil Conservation Service was realizing the need for conservation of our natural resources and agricultural land. All that kind of came at a head, and they realized that if we took these excise tax dollars that were already in place but just going to the Treasury and We earmarked those to be returned back to the states for the sake of wildlife conservation and habitat management, that it could go real far. And so back in the 30s up till today, this model has existed. It's a kind of a convoluted process, as most things are, in terms of how that comes back to the state. But the crucial link is that it's dependent on license sales within the state in terms of dictating how much of those funds get returned back to that individual state to be used for wildlife and habitat conservation. So that's, I guess, in a nutshell, the link in how people may have heard that hunting and angling is doing a lot for conservation. That's how it is. It's an embedded excise tax that gets brought back to the states to be used by local DNRs to manage both game and non-game species and all habitat types, managing public lands, bringing hunter education and hunter safety programs out to the state publics.
So it sounds like a big ripple effect that could have probably for years have an impact on our economy and the future in Wisconsin. Is that correct?
Yeah. And like you had mentioned, in the most recent 2016 report from the Fish and Wildlife Service, where they do a national survey of the public to determine how many licensed buyers there are, and we've been seeing a steady decline since about the early 80s in terms of a crowd that's, you know, the baby boomer generation, essentially, that's been carrying a big population load of hunters and anglers are starting to hit the age where they're not as able to get out and get around as much, and they're starting to kind of age out of being active participants. Mm-hmm. And for a variety of reasons, the generations that followed have not necessarily participated at the same rates. And so we see these projections where they call it the cliff when sure. we're in our circles and we're talking about these projections that in 20, 30 years or so, there's very much likely to be a significant drop in active participants and active license purchasing that is very worrying to a lot of the conservation scientists out there watching how the funding levels are coming in. So that's a big reason for an increased effort to do more of this outreach to get new people exposed and provide more opportunities for people to give a try at hunting and fishing. And there's a variety of reasons that people get involved with it, you know, everything from being worried about conservation to being interested in self-reliance to local food and,
Okay. All right.
All right. So then that gives us a chance to talk about the positive side, and that is that there's been a significant increase in the number of women who are hunting now. That's the fastest growing demographic yep. of licensed buyers. And then Marty and I have been working on a project, an initiative, I should say, called R3. It's actually nationwide. Lots of folks in the conservation community are focused on this idea of recruitment, retention, and reactivation of people in hunting. So we're looking at recruitment and retention and offering these learn to hunt for food programs and learn to fish for dinner is what we're calling them. And what we're noticing is that there are a lot of young people, millennials, college age, and young professionals who are interested in getting their own food, to, as Marty said, find local, organic, sustainable food to put in their freezer, a turn away from going to the grocery store and buying a piece of meat that comes on pink styrofoam and wrapped in plastic.
Mm-hmm.
The local food and sustainability thing is really important to that demographic. And in offering these programs throughout, how long has it been, Marty? 10 years of Learn to Hunt for Adults now.
At least 10,
actually,
yeah.
Yeah. We're just seeing a really big uptick in the number of people who want to do this and are probably, we don't have enough workforce to offer these programs for everybody who wants to do it. So that's what we're looking at growing throughout the state right now.
Excellent.
In conjunction with other conservation organizations like National Wild Turkey Federation and some local smaller rod and gun club folks who are partnering to offer these learn to hunt for food and learn to fish for dinner opportunities.
Great. We need to take a short break. Peggy Farrell and Marty Moses are our guests today on Route 51. When we return, we'll pick this conversation right back up, talk about the changing demographics of outdoor recreation, some specific initiatives underway to encourage more participation by both women and young people. You can join the conversation as well at 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I see trees that are green, red roses too. I watch them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Peggy Farrell and Marty Moses are our guests today on Route 51. You can join us as well by calling 800-780-9742. And it certainly is a wonderful world. Getting involved in outdoor recreation can increase confidence. It can help people find peace in nature. And these experiences, whether we're talking about fly fishing or kayaking or camping, hunting, they bring a cultural experience and a value system to our society, not to mention the bonding and the memories that are created through these types of experiences. And it's really interesting to see these great initiatives that are underway to encourage more people to participate. You know, I've got to tell you, bow hunting in particular, seeing a pretty big surge for women. Peggy, why do you think that is?
Well, I would say the people that I meet through becoming an outdoors woman are, first of all, they're largely in the age of like 40 to 60. We certainly have folks on the younger side, and age 93 was our oldest participant. But I think a lot of women in that main demographic that come to our program are looking to have a connection with nature, like many other folks, a connection with where their food comes from. And bow hunting seems to be a really contemplative, peaceful way to do that. You're out at a time of year when it's not so cold. It's not, you know, snowy and 20 below like it can be during our traditional 9-day gun deer season in Wisconsin. An opportunity to sit silently and just sort of blend in with nature. And then for many of them, whatever happens after that is just a bonus. If there is an opportunity to harvest food and put that in the freezer, that's great. But particularly for beginners, that's not necessarily what they're looking for. It's more of the connection to nature.
Okay. We do have a caller. Brian is calling from Dorchester. And Brian has a question about the term organic. Brian, thanks for calling in.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, I was so puzzled how they can call it or term it organic source of protein when the wildlife is out foraging cropland, which is a lot of GMO traded crops.
Yeah, I get you. I think that is kind of thrown around loosely sometimes. Maybe not organic, like in what the USDA deems organic, but just more natural is, I think, a better way to put it. Yeah, a lot of our deer are foraging farm-raised crops, and they're not just sticking to the organic fields, so that can't be guaranteed. But I think that it is. It gives a lot of people who choose to eat meat a peace of mind that it's not factory farmed meat. So that's how I see the difference. But Marty, you chime in on that.
Agreed. That's been a point of discussion that my colleagues and I we've talked about that at many of our classes that gets brought up. And similar to what Peggy's response was there, you know, that organic term, we do throw it around loosely. It's definitely not a certified process, and it's more of the ethical harvest or about ethical hunting and killing and accessing your own protein that you know has been free ranging and living a life of its own accord, more or less, is really, I think, what most of our foodie related participants are really interested in, as opposed to being quote unquote organic. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian, for calling us out on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And one thing that I know that both of your groups do is teaching people how to harvest and catch their own food. Is there a lot of interest in this right now? I mean, is that something that people are really gravitating toward?
I would say that yes. We're at a point where we're at a scalability issue to be able to provide enough of these opportunities to participants. We have waiting lists, especially in the greater Madison area, because these programs have been rolled out for a longer time there. And word of mouth has been our biggest advertising opportunity. And folks go through this, they have a great experience, they tell their couple of friends, and before you know it, they're knocking on the door waiting to get in line. And we've got waiting lists. We're trying to run tandem events. Now, what we hit there is a trigger point, because our hunts are mentored hunts, and we need individuals who are currently hunters and capable of helping folks in the field. And we're really finding a bottleneck in our ability to get out and host more of these events because of a lack of mentors who are lined up at the same capacity as the new participants who are interested in joining. And to kind of try to tackle that issue, another program that Peggy and myself and a couple others are working on is a mentor training program, where we provide an opportunity to educate folks who have an interest to go above and beyond kind of the typical youth-styled learn to hunt, where it's kind of an afternoon in the field with people. Our events are a little more comprehensive, generally multi-day, oftentimes with a co-ed, but usually separated, a co-ed camp style, so that folks can experience the full magnitude of what it means to kind of be out camping, whether we're in tents or we're in a lodge or something along those lines. So we need people who are willing and ready to step up a little bit more and pass along some of their knowledge. And you need to know what you're doing, but you don't need to be an expert. You're not a guide. You're not going to be out there trying to guarantee that a hunt will be successful, because rarely, or, you know, it's hard. You can never guarantee that sort of situation, but someone who knows how to be safe and how to discuss the subtle nuances of why you're there and where you're there in terms of the habitat and the behavior of the animal you're hunting. And, but that currently is our biggest roadblock, is not enough folks who can help us when we're out there.
So you're really trying to recruit some people for that youth mentoring, the mentored hunts, basically.
We don't have a problem getting folks for the youth mentored hunts. There are a lot of organizations out there running the youth mentored hunts. It's this new idea of the adult-focused hunts that are maybe multi-day. We're not... You know, it's still somewhat new, and it's a new idea that we're bringing around to people. And everyone, I'm sure Peggy can vouch for this, folks who come and join us on a mentored hunt, the mentors themselves, at the end of it, they look at us and say, this was great. Let me know when you're doing the next one. I'll be glad to help you. But we want to be cognizant of burnout, too, because you can only ask the same volunteer to come and help you so many times before they start to also get burned out on it. So the more folks and the more diverse people that we can get helping us, the better.
Peggy,
I think that for a lot of years, the focus has been on getting kids out. I think that we had the notion that if we don't get kids when they're young and get them into us, then they won't carry it on into adulthood. And so we need the children to maintain our tradition of hunting. But after lots of years of effort of doing these children-focused programs, the needle is not moving on those hunting license sales. And I think it's because the kids who are coming to those Learn to Hunt programs are already in a hunting family, so they were going to do it whether or not we did a special program for them. And so that's why we've kind of switched the focus to adults. And Some people don't agree with that. They still think that kids need that extra attention more. But in doing these mentor training programs that Marty and I have been offering throughout the state, when we explain that to people who are hunters and invite them to take adults out to teach them to hunt, it's kind of like, well, I never thought of that before. And the mentors walk away after those learn to hunt saying, you know what, that was almost more fun than going hunting myself. So we just need a big crew of people to reach those folks who are open-minded and willing to do that, to take adults out, and then we can start moving that needle.
That's
a couple of extra thoughts, if I may, a couple other thoughts to follow up with Peggy's comment there, too, is the past focus on youth hunts, you know, it's one of those yes and things that we often say. We definitely aren't ever going to turn away from doing the youth events. Those are great, and they will continue to be used. A lot of our organizations pride themselves on them, and we will continue to champion that. But it boils down to almost three simple statements when you look at the alternative or the parallel to that in these adult-focused events is adults have money, they have a car, and they have a desire to go out there and do it. So those three things combined should, in theory, you know, other researchers have been studying this to a great degree. We're kind of the field implementers. We're not the researchers studying it, but people have been looking at that. And, you know, we ought to be able to see a greater increase in participation rates because of that. We've got people can immediately be buying licenses and participating. Plus, add on to the fact that you get these late 20, early 30-somethings who are out of college, budding professionals, starting their careers, developing families of their own, who become engaged, they in turn will then have children that they bring into the hunting and angling traditions on their own. And we don't even need to teach them or reach out to them. So it's kind of one of those multiplier effects that we're also going for.
Well, Marty, you're a prime example of that. You're somebody who didn't hunt until you were an adult.
Right.
Exactly right. And I've got a 7-year-old boy who is very much interested in it now, and it will come sit with me in my turkey blind this spring, and he's got a youth compound bow, and we practice together.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. And then you think about how much of as we talked about earlier, how much of an economic impact hunting and fishing and all of these activities have on our state, not just from, from the licensing, but also from a tourism standpoint. I mean, there's so many aspects to consider. Yes?
Absolutely.
So, Peggy, you know, I really want to talk about some of the programs that you offer from Wisconsin's Becoming an Outdoors Woman program. I see that the first workshop was held at Tree Haven near Tomahawk, and that one was filled to capacity, over 100 participants. Now you have two signature workshops, and then how many other smaller workshops throughout the year?
Well, let's see. This year we've got 11 different smaller workshops. The two signature workshops are held, as you said, at Tree Haven Field Station, which is up by Tomahawk. It's run by the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point College of Natural Resources. So in winter, we do a 3-day workshop with winter activities like snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, ice fishing, over 20 different classes that people get to choose from. Similar structure for an August program at the same facility, but then we do more summer activities like kayaking, camping, canoeing, archery. We do shotgun, rifle, just the gamut of activities. But those smaller events that might be shorter in duration and for a smaller group of people are usually single topic things like Learn to Hunt Pheasants with Dogs is coming up. We do a fly fishing weekend. We'll do charter fishing on Lake Michigan sometime this summer. A couple of kayak trips. We're going to try a foraging workshop this fall for mushrooms and other wild edibles. So we try to get all around the state and do a really big variety of things so that there's something for everyone, because not everybody wants to learn how to shoot a shotgun or catch a fish out of the hole in the ice kind of thing.
Right.
So, but what's interesting is that we find that people who think they might not be interested in one type of activity will come and do the things that are comfortable and compelling to them, say kayaking. But then in the course of that event, as they're around other women who are trying things that are different from what they've chosen to participate in, it sort of opens their eyes and they go, well, gee, look at that person. They're not that different from me. They don't have any special skills that allow them to be successful at doing that rock climbing. I might come back and try this again. So it opens up the possibilities to people, and it makes them sort of step outside their comfort zone and try things that they didn't think they might ever be interested in.
Have the workshops changed over the years? I mean, have they evolved over time?
Not really. So that basic core 3-day workshop with all those different events that I described, that was the original model of the program. That first workshop was offered in Wisconsin in 1991. And then other state natural resource agencies heard about the success of that program and started calling and saying, hey, you're doing these women programs. Can you help us do it and be successful too? So the program started to spread, and now it's offered in 38 states and 6 Canadian provinces with that same structure, that same formula, which also includes the classes are equally divided between one-third hunting and shooting, one-third fishing and boating, and then that last third, all that other different stuff. So that basic premise has held true ever since the very first workshop. What's different is that we're adding on all these other specialty workshops that we call Beyond Bow or the Learn to Hunt activities so that we can expand it to people who might not be able to, say, spend a whole 3-day weekend doing a special workshop. Maybe they just can only afford or take the time to do a day-long thing, but they still get an opportunity to come and do something. So that's the only thing that's changed, but I think it's really interesting and genius that the creator of the program, Dr. Christine Thomas, who is the dean of the College of Natural Resources at UWSP, just hit straight on with that original formula of the 3-day workshop and those different courses with equally divided offerings being the magic button that holds true and is still successful for today.
Thank you, Peggy. Peggy Farrell and Marty Moses are our guests today on Route 51. And when we return, we'll pick up the conversation, talking about some upcoming events designed to give both women and youth and other adults the opportunity to experience the great outdoors. You can join the conversation as well, 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Peggy Farrell and Marty Moses are our guests today discussing the great outdoors and efforts to diversify participation in outdoor recreation. You can join us as well at 800-780-9742. Just saw this this really startling statistic. Back in 1992, a rural sociologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison made a prediction that if sociological trends like increased urbanization, smaller family sizes, and a growing anti-hunting sentiment back then, in the sport of hunting could be extinct by the year 2050. That startled me. What do you two think about that?
Marty, you go first.
Yeah, Marty.
Boy, I mean, that is startling. I would find it hard to believe, because I think since then there's been a lot of public opinion polling out there that has actually turned the tide on the view of hunting, particularly when you label hunting in a particular way. If you're talking about hunting as a way to spend time connecting with nature and sourcing a meal and protein and putting food into your freezer, the opinion of the general public in that regard is looked at very much more favorably than say, someone who labels it more as a sport and a way to kind of put a trophy on the wall. And we are very much, there are a lot of organizations, and the kind of work that Peggy and I do and what the DNR supports is really trying to change that narrative of what it means to be a hunter or an angler, and that the vast majority of folks who participate in these activities are more in the line of a contemplative person wanting to connect with nature, spend time out there, spend time with family, and at the same time find a way to put some meat in the freezer. So it would be interesting to revisit that study and, you know, try to do it as a follow-up and really see where we stand. But I sure hope it doesn't come true.
Well, sure. And I think that, you know, it sounds like both of you have programs that are really working to accomplish a change in that. And of course, if hunting goes away or there's more empathetic views toward nature, national parks can lose funding. Conservation efforts could decline. I mean, that there's a whole ripple effect could happen.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So through
go ahead, Peggy.
Oh, I was just going to say that through outreach education programs like Becoming an Outdoors Woman, we're not necessarily out there to hardcore turn everybody into a hunter. A lot of the women who come to our workshops might not have any interest in it. Some of them might even be kind of leaning anti-hunting, or a couple of them even virulent anti-hunters, but they still see enough value in our program to give it a try. And when they leave, they start to have a little better understanding of who hunters are, what hunting is about, how it contributes to conservation. So if the people who participate in bow workshops never pick up a gun and never hunt, at the very least, they come away with a better understanding of what people in outdoor recreation contribute to conservation. And I think that's really important.
Sure. Marty, you were about to say something when Peggy started. What were you going to follow up and say?
I was going to kind of double back on your comments too, of the economic impact that hunting has on especially a lot of the rural communities, and how important that is, that if that stream of, even if it's just seasonal, but that stream of income to some of the local communities, that would be very detrimental as well to their local viability. Everything from hotels to gas stations to cafes and coffee shops would all feel an impact if the participation rates really decline down and hunting goes extinct to that degree.
So I noticed something called the No Child Left Indoors Initiative. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That's our keystone education and outreach kind of program that Pheasants Forever has. And it spans a wide variety of activities. And it really hits the ground with our chapters. So that was something I also didn't mention at the forefront when I was kind of introducing what Pheasants Forever is. We would only exist because of a dedicated volunteer base that is formulated through local chapters around the nation. We've got nearly 700 chapters across the nation. Here in Wisconsin, we have 30. And the chapters are local folks who care deeply about their local habitats and their local communities. And they provide opportunities, anything from a youth pollinator day where school groups will come out to an identified 1-acre site on some local farmer's land or perhaps a public land, a schoolyard, for instance, and we'll learn about the importance of pollinators and how pollinators play a major role in our food systems and in our agricultural systems and in our natural systems. They'll go through a learning process, activities, and then in the culmination of it, they plant a pollinator plot that is a mix of diverse prairie species as well as flowering plants to accommodate all sorts of pollinators. They'll work on nesting structures and such like that. We have a lot of lot of youth events where it's a learn to shoot class, so giving youth an opportunity to experience shotgun skills, and that can roll over into a learn to hunt and a guided pheasant hunt that the chapters will help on. So it's activities along those lines where our NCLI program and initiative comes in.
And I know you don't just focus on recruiting young hunters to hunt, but young hunters as future conservationists. We touched on this a little bit, but maybe explain why this is such an important aspect to what you do, and, you know, encouraging young hunters to be future conservationists.
Absolutely. I mean, anytime that we can impart a greater understanding and appreciation of our local greater community, not just the people, but the animals and the wild places and the odd areas that we have around, an understanding of that, you know, a deeper appreciation they will have as they move forward and become voters, become active participants and citizens in their communities, and be a voice for protecting and saving, enhancing, restoring, conserving all of those areas. One of the programs that we also have right now, it is called Women on the Wing. And under the Women on the Wing events that Pheasants Forever hosts is a particular program called Women Caring for the Land. And it's an opportunity to bring specifically women landowners and those that are non-operating landowners to learn more about conservation programs that can help them manage their land into the future, whether they're working with a tenant farmer who will come in and, you know, farm the property on their behalf. They can now have a better understanding of the conservation programs that are available through the Farm Bill and through local and state governments to help facilitate proper management of the soils and waters on their property, as well as the habitat that might exist in some of the non-farmed areas. So we're really trying to span the all opportunities to impart the land ethic to everyone who we engage with.
Interesting. I want to remind folks that they can call in at 800-780-9742 if they'd like to be part of the conversation today. Peggy, you know, I have to wonder, what are some of the barriers you think women face when they want to get involved in these programs?
So actually that was the whole jumping off point for the creation of the program. Some people thought, why are women underrepresented in outdoor activities? There must be some barriers that are keeping them from doing it. So a conference was held at UW-Stevens Point to take a look at identifying barriers and then also finding some strategies. And the list of barriers that these focus groups came up with were things like, well, women sort of have this perceived image of hunters as slobs or as trophy hunters, and that's not appealing. But by and large, the barriers identified all sort of related back to no place to go learn, lack of educational opportunity. So this group of, I want to call them visionaries, that sounds maybe like a lot, but they were visionary. This group of people who worked on this idea said, well, if they don't have any place to learn, let's give them one and see what happens. And, you know, what happened is what I explained before. The program went from that one workshop here in Wisconsin to all across North America. I think some of those barriers have been taken away now. The educational barrier has certainly become lessened as more and more opportunities are out there for women, not just through becoming an outdoors woman, but Turkey Federation does a Women in the Outdoors program. Marty talked about the Women on the Wing thing that they do. There are some barriers that we're not ever going to take away, like lack of time, nobody to watch the kids. But the educational component, I think, is really key, and we're chipping away at that and making more opportunities for women every year.
It does sound like a challenge to get women to realize that hunting and fishing are just activities that are just for men. Yes?
Yes. I think part of the challenge is we hear from a lot of women like, hey, I'd like to do this. My husband or my boyfriend or my dad or my uncle wants to take me out to do this, but I'm not comfortable learning from them. So what we provide is that safe and supportive place to learn where they can get enough confidence where they can, you know, go out on their own or now go out with their husband and learn a little bit more. So it's not true straight across the board, but oftentimes your significant other isn't the best person to learn from. It sounds, Shireen, like you had a good learning experience with the kayak and your husband. I did not when my significant other tried to teach me how to roll a kayak to flip it over and then right to begin yourself. I nearly creamed him with the kayak paddle. However, he was a really good teacher for everybody else but me. So I had to go elsewhere to learn how to do that. And then once I got that under my belt, we could go out and kayak together and have a lovely time. Just, you know, sometimes you need somebody else other than the one closest to you to teach you how. And, you know, that's what our program offers.
Well, sure. And I think that's really important to have that comfort level. And sometimes when you're with your significant other, emotions can run high. You feel embarrassed. There can be all kinds of things. That's why my husband will never teach me how to play golf. I'll tell you that.
Right? Excellent. yeah, you get it.
Yeah, I do get it. Absolutely. Well, so, looking over the courses, what are the most popular subjects that you offer? I mean, what are people are gravitating to? I see Dutch oven cooking as part of one of the workshops, wild edibles. And I have to know, what is tackling trailers? What does that mean?
Oh, so we say one of the biggest barriers to going fishing is backing up the boat.
Oh, yeah.
Launching the boat at the boat launch, getting it off the trailer and back on again. And trailering a boat is a challenge for both men and women. So that's what tackling trailers is all about. Once you've got that down, then there's no excuse not to go fishing, right? but as far as the what's popular, it goes in cycles. It's really interesting. For a while, we couldn't offer enough archery classes because they were filling right away. And now maybe people are finding other avenues for learning archery because we're not seeing a big push for that. But fly fishing is always really big. Our shooting events right now are really big. And for some people who think that they might not want to try shooting, we have just a basic firearm safety handling class where they don't actually shoot. They just get exposure to a whole bunch of different guns, learn how to safely pick them up, examine them to make sure that they're not loaded, learn how you would load and unload a gun. And I always think it's really cool that there's a certain percentage of women who come just because they want the knowledge. There's a little fear there or maybe a little misunderstanding or hesitation, and they think, what am I going to do about it? Knowledge is empowerment. So they come to learn just that so that they feel more comfortable. It takes the mystery away, makes them feel more empowered about the knowledge that they've received.
So I want to give you both the opportunity to tell people where they can find out more information about your programs. Marty, what's the best website to visit?
Right now, most of our programs are being advertised through the Go Wild system. That's the DNR's interface for purchasing license and tags and other educational activities. So we are always posting ours under the education section. And if someone were to search Go Wild, if they were to search Hunt for Food under the Go Wild educational programs, they will find the list of current events. We also have, they're often posted on the DNR's Learn to Hunt website and the Outdoor Skills website. Then finally, Pheasants Forever's Wisconsin Pheasant Forever on Facebook, we will be advertising events that we are particularly engaged with.
Okay, so listeners can follow that Facebook page and be updated about what's happening. Okay, Peggy, what about Wisconsin's Becoming an Outdoors Woman program? What is the best place to get information about those programs?
Well, we're on Facebook as well, so just Wisconsin Bow, B-O-W, a search on Facebook will land you there. Our regular website is kind of buried in academia because we're part of the UWSP College of Natural Resources. But if somebody just Googles Wisconsin BOW, I think the first hit that comes up on Google is our calendar of events.
Okay. All right. So easy to find information about these programs, and really want to encourage everybody to take a look and find out what programs might be available upcoming. What's the next program coming up, Peggy?
Learning to hunt pheasants with dogs on May 4th. That's going to be at the Mead Wildlife Area, which is just a little southwest of Knowlton.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, that is all we have time for today on Route 51. I am Shereen Seewert. I'd like to thank our guests, Peggy Farrell and Marty Moses. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Jane Richter is our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Lisa McHugh, Ava Cassidy, and Tim McGraw. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51.
Marching into the night, they disappear to the left and right again. Another supper from a sack, a 99-cent heart attack. I got a pounding head and